going to use the food coloring in his breakfast. Greg looked at him, confused. Alex, we don't use food coloring in our milk.
Why not, Daddy?
Greg turned to me. We just don't do that, right, Mommy? Meanwhile, Alex has taken the cap off the little red bottle, and soon his cereal swam happily in pink milk. Greg frowned. As he sipped his coffee and kept quiet, he seemed to be struggling with the same urge I'd felt, seeing Olivia exploring the kitchen. He was resisting the impulse to put the cap back on the bottle of food coloring and pour our son a fresh bowl of cereal, while at the same time asking himself, why really shouldn't the milk be pink? And perhaps what other colors could breakfast be? In 2000, the British Broadcasting Corporation, known across the globe as the BBC, was facing challenges on many fronts. Established in 1922 as a private company, it initially broadcasted programs to radio owners. Its first director general, John Reith, had a clear vision for the BBC to educate, inform, and entertain British people. In the years that followed, the BBC grew and developed television broadcasting. It also entered the news business, and later on it started offering digital services like the 24-hour BBC News Service and the BBC Online. The company became one of Britain's best-known global brands. But in the late 1980s and 1990s, the marketplace started to change, and the media industry went through a seismic shift. The 90s saw the arrival of a new digital broadcast technology known as cable, which gave consumers many more choices, twice as many channels as compared to analog technology, better quality of services, and internet access. The commercial channels risked losing audiences and, with that, advertising revenues. Yet the BBC had no clear vision or strategy for how to adapt. To compound the problem, the BBC itself was going through some tough struggles internally. It had lost its vitality, and the quality of its content was suffering. There were 168 different business units all operating within the BBC, and complexity and confusion had taken over what had once been a well-organized workplace. A group of employees had come up with a three-word description for the BBC: despondent, down, and dismayed. In 2000, the company brought in a man named Greg Dyke to be its new director general. Dyke had begun his career as a journalist, eventually entering broadcasting, and became director of programs for London Weekend Television in 1987, and then served as the company's group chief executive. In 1995, he joined Pearson Television as CEO. Over the years, Dyke developed a reputation for being a charismatic leader with a remarkable track record in television. Early on in his career, for example, while working as program director of a new morning TV franchise at London Weekend Television called TVAM, Dyke rescued the channel by promoting a puppet called Roland Rat to do a regular slot every morning and introducing cartoons for younger viewers. If children liked Roland and watched the show, Dyke predicted, then their mothers would keep the channel on. The ratings went up, and so did the number of people who watched the channel, from about 200,000 when Dyke started, to 4,000 people just 1 month after his arrival, to 1.5 million by the end of his first year in charge. The BBC presented a different kind of challenge for Dyke. It was much larger than his previous employers, and had a deep connection to the public sector. Though the BBC operated independently from the British government, there were strong ties between the two entities. The government signed off on the BBC's long-term charter, and it also appointed the chairman of the BBC Trust. Dyke came up with an interesting transition plan. He overlapped with his predecessor, John Burt, by 5 months, and spent that time getting to know the BBC. Burt had developed a reputation for leading the BBC from his office in London. Dyke, instead, began traveling all around the United Kingdom, from Wales to Northern Ireland to Scotland, from the well-known BBC facilities to the most remote ones. He visited every major location and traveled to offices that had never received a visit from a director general in the past. At each location, he met with the entire staff. Confounding employees' expectations, he didn't give a lengthy presentation about what he planned to change. Instead, he asked a simple question:
What is the one thing I should do to make things better for you? Then Dyke would sit down and listen to the responses. After that, he asked a follow-up question. What is the one thing I should do to make things better for our viewers and listeners? Dyke's first move in one of the most powerful jobs in British broadcasting was remarkable. People generally fear that asking questions will make them look foolish, especially when they are asking for help with large problems that have been around for some time. Aren't leaders supposed to provide answers? Management books are filled with guidelines on how leaders can make long-lasting first impressions by communicating their vision right from the start, make clear who's in charge, for example, and delegate when appropriate. CEOs joining organizations are expected to start implementing their vision, not to spend time asking others how they can be most helpful to them. Many leaders in Dyke's position, brought in to fix the problems of a deeply troubled organization, would have talked rather than asked questions, and most of us would have the same impulse. When Dyke made his visits, he didn't have lunch in the executive dining room. Rather, he'd often grab a tray in the cafeteria with the staff and keep asking them questions. Dyke learned that employees were frustrated by the many top-down changes Bert had put in place without asking for input. They felt unmotivated and disempowered. Many believed the BBC had lost its creative spark. They also complained that facilities were badly in need of updating. By Dyke's first official day on the job, when he formally addressed the staff, they were eager to hear his plans for the future and to work with him to implement them. Dyke explained that he wanted to shift the BBC's goal from being the best-managed organization in the public sector, as his predecessor had suggested, to being the most innovative and risk-taking place there is. As a signal for the change he wanted to create, Dyke distributed yellow cards that looked like the penalty cards that soccer referees hold up when they're cautioning a player. He encouraged the staff to use the cards to cut the crap and make it happen. If anyone saw or heard someone trying to block a good idea, they should wave the yellow card in the air and state their case. Dyke's unconventional approach paid off. Within a year of his arrival at the BBC, ratings increased for both BBC One and BBC Two, and audience satisfaction with the BBC increased overall from a 6 out of 10 just before Dyke arrived to a 6.8. In July 2002, ratings for the flagship station BBC One surpassed those of its main competitor, ITV, for the first time in many years. BBC Radio reached record audiences. The BBC also dramatically reduced its overhead, allowing it to put an additional £270 million into new broadcasting programs, and the upgrades that the employees wanted were also put in place. The way that we typically think about the effect of asking questions, especially when we are in leadership positions, is just plain wrong. We fear that others will judge us negatively for not having all the answers, when, in truth, it's just the opposite. When we interact with others by asking questions, our relationships grow stronger because we are showing genuine interest in learning about them, hearing their ideas, and getting to know them more personally. As a result, we gain their trust, and our relationship becomes more interesting and intimate. If you are worried that by asking a question you may come across as incompetent, you have that wrong also. People think of us as being smarter when we ask questions than when we don't. To demonstrate the value of asking questions, my colleagues and I recruited a group of 170 students. We sat them down in front of computers and told them that they would be matched with another person taking the study, who would remain anonymous. What they did not know was that their partner was a computer-simulated actor. As a cover story, participants were told that the study was about understanding how instant messaging influences performance on a brain teaser. Participants then had to solve the task under time pressure, and they learned that their partner would also be completing it later in the study. They were told that their performance mattered, as they would be paid a bonus for each of the 5 problems in the brain teaser that they solved correctly. To make sure the participants had no doubts that their partner was a real person, we gave them the opportunity to send an instant message to their partner at the beginning of the study. The computer-simulated actor did not provide a direct response to the message, but simply sent one to them that said, "Hey, good luck." Once they had completed the brain teaser, the participants received another message from their partner. Depending on the condition they had been randomly assigned to, they received one of two messages: "I hope it went well," or "I hope it went well, do you have any advice?" Participants could respond to this message after they received it, knowing they would not hear back. They then evaluated how competent they thought their partner was and reported on how likely they would be to ask their partner for advice on a similar task in the future. Participants who had a partner who asked them for advice rated the advice seeker higher on competence. They also indicated that they would be more likely to turn to their partner for advice. Thus, contrary to what we tend to believe, asking for advice increases rather than decreases how competent we are perceived to be. We underestimate how flattering it is to be asked for advice. By asking questions, we give others the opportunity to share their personal experience and wisdom, thus stroking their ego. Curiosity is a way of being rebellious in the world. Rebels fight their fears and are willing to push past the discomfort of showing others that they need their help. It may feel scary, but it brings about all sorts of benefits. Curiosity is related to both greater positive emotions and greater closeness when we interact with strangers for the first time. In one study my colleagues and I conducted, we had college students engage in conversations with a peer where they were instructed to ask many questions or just a few. Students liked their partner more when they received more questions, we found, simply because that gave them the opportunity to talk and disclose information about themselves. People who ask more questions are better liked, our research shows, and speed daters who ask more questions get more second dates. In another study, undergraduates who didn't know each other were instructed to either engage in a conversation with a peer designed to generate intimacy, asking questions like, "For what in your life do you feel most grateful?" or they engaged in casual small talk. Those who had an intimate conversation reported feeling closer to their partner and happier than those who engaged in small talk. Yet, we are usually reluctant to ask more probing questions like this, believing we're getting too personal and that we should mind our own business instead. Research has also found curiosity to be associated with greater satisfaction and a greater sense of social support in existing relationships. When arriving home after a day of work, you'll feel more connected to your partner if you show you are curious about how their day went. In a newer relationship, you'll have a more enjoyable date and you'll be more excited to have another if your partner asks questions that lead you to share more about yourself. When you show curiosity by asking questions, others share more and they return the favor asking questions of you. This sets up a spiral of give and take that fosters intimacy. When we open ourselves to curiosity, we are more apt to reframe situations in a positive way. Curiosity makes us much more likely to view a tough problem at work as an interesting challenge to take on. A stressful meeting with our boss becomes an opportunity to learn. A nerve-wracking first date becomes an exciting night out with a new person. A colander becomes a hat. In general, curiosity motivates us to view stressful situations as challenges rather than threats, to talk about difficulties more openly, and to try new approaches to solving problems. In fact, curiosity is associated with less defensive reactions to stress and, as a result, less aggression when we respond to a provocation. In a diary study conducted each day over 4 weeks, people who had higher tolerance for uncertainty indicated that they had conflicts with friends less often, less passive-aggressive reactions, and were more willing to excuse transgressions. Curiosity, in short, translates into greater engagement with others and with the world, thanks to the exploratory behavior and learning that it inspires. How we express our curiosity has its roots in childhood and can be shaped by the lessons we are taught as we grow up. In one study, researchers showed 8- and 9-year-olds a school science project called the Bouncing Raisins, which involves adding raisins to a mixture of vinegar and baking soda and watching them bounce up to the top of the glass. After the activity, the experimenter responded to the children differently. For half the children, she asked, "I wonder what would happen if we dropped one of these," picking up a Skittles candy from the table, "into the liquid instead of a raisin." To the other half of the children, she simply said, "I'm just going to tidy up a bit. I'll put these materials over here, as she cleaned up the work area. In both scenarios, the experimenter then left the room, saying, "Feel free to do whatever you want while you are waiting for me. You can use the materials more, or draw with these crayons, or just wait. Whatever you want to do is fine." Children in the first group, who had seen their guide deviate from the task so that she could satisfy her own curiosity, tended to play with the materials much more, dropping raisins, Skittles, and other items into the liquid. Children who instead had seen her tidy up were more likely to simply do nothing. A teacher's behavior has a powerful effect on a child's disposition to explore. Similarly, a manager's actions can influence the curiosity and creativity of those in their organization. At Intuit, when curiosity results in innovations that are particularly creative, it is recognized with a Scott Cook Innovation Award. But there is also the Greatest Failure Award, which celebrates curiosity that did not lead to a good result, but still offered an important learning opportunity. The award comes with a failure party. The same researchers then flipped the bouncing raisin study to measure how teachers would respond to children's displays of curiosity and exploration. The teachers who volunteered were asked to do the same experiment with a student whom the experimenters had instructed to behave in a certain way, unbeknownst to the teachers. Half of the teachers were told that the focus of the lesson was to learn about science. The other half were told that the focus of the lesson was filling out a worksheet. The teachers began by showing the children the bouncing raisins experiment, as before. This time, the students were instructed to stray from the instructions and put a Skittle into the glass. If the teacher asked the child what she was doing, the student was trained to reply, "I just wanted to see what would happen." The results were striking. Teachers who believed that the goal of the lesson was learning about science responded to the diversion with interest and encouragement, saying things like, "Oh, what are you trying?" or "Maybe we should see what this will do." But those teachers who had been encouraged to focus on completing the worksheet said things like, "Oh, wait a second, that's not on the instruction sheet," or "Whoops, that doesn't go in there." How we react to the exploration and experimentation of our colleagues or subordinates is likely to directly influence whether they feel comfortable exploring their curiosity. A workplace with failure parties is going to yield a lot more creativity than one where efficiency is celebrated above all else. As in the case of the production of Model Ts at Ford Motor, or the urge we feel as parents when we want to stop our children in their messy explorations of the world, I fear that schools may be too focused on perfecting skills or preparing for tests in ways that are detrimental to curiosity. While checking out schools for Alex's pre-K year, I saw a teacher in one of the classes teaching children how to draw perfect triangles, squares, and circles, and then color them. She seemed particularly interested in having the shapes be properly drawn, and when the children colored, she continually reminded them not to color outside the lines. Focusing on teaching children to avoid making mistakes, to perform well on standardized tests, or to be well-behaved may lead teachers to forget what education is about, at least in my mind, the beauty of fueling and nurturing their natural curiosity so that they will keep asking questions about the world. I also fear that workplaces are not that different in their approach to curiosity. By following rules and orders in executing the work, employees lose the sense of wonder that could lead them to approach the job differently. Massimiliano, or Max, Zanardi is a manager who knows how to tap into his employees' curiosity and his own to run a better business. He likes to introduce himself as 100% Italian and 50% Turkish. He was born in Italy but spent many years living in Turkey. Like many Italians, Zanardi talks in an animated fashion and uses lots of hand gestures. He was the general manager of the Ritz-Carlton in Istanbul for several years, playing a key role in the hotel's opening and working hard to improve customers' experiences. In 2015, the hotel was voted Turkey's best luxury hotel in the prestigious Business Destinations Travel Awards, and Business Destinations magazine praised the hotel as standing out for its innovation, unparalleled facilities, and the passion of its employees for the work they do. Standing in the lobby, you will enjoy the subtle fragrance of the hotel's bespoke perfume. and throughout public areas in the hotel, carefully selected contemporary music inspires you to smile or even do a little dance. The hotel's employees attribute their passion to the way that Zanardi encouraged them to always ask questions. As general manager, Zanardi regularly challenged employees to redefine luxury by asking why and what if. For example, each year employees were used to planting flowers on the terrace right outside the hotel's restaurant. One day, when it was time to fill the pots and choose what to plant, Zanardi asked staff members, "Why do we always plant flowers? How about vegetables? What about herbs?" This conversation eventually led to a terrace garden full of herbs and heirloom tomatoes that were used in the hotel's acclaimed restaurant, Atelier Real Food. All of this from asking a few simple questions. On October 29, 1908, in a small, picturesque town in the foothills of the Italian Alps, Camillo Olivetti founded Italy's first typewriter factory as a family business. A gifted and eclectic engineer, Olivetti had been inspired by a visit to the United States to import typewriters to Italy, and then later to manufacture them. Olivetti started with 20 employees who assembled about 20 machines per week. Under its founder's direction, the company, called simply Olivetti, grew rapidly. By the early 1920s, it had 250 employees and was producing over 2,000 machines a year. In 1924, Camillo's son, Adriano, joined the family business after graduating from college. He started as a production worker on the factory floor. Adriano noticed the monotony of many of the tasks employees completed day after day and the tough working conditions. There was not enough light inside the factory, nor enough time for breaks. Workers were also too isolated from one another, he thought, with each person handling a different step of the production process, and their hours were too long. Adriano was struck by the fact that, as workers completed routinized and simplified tasks in the style of Fordism, they stopped thinking. Work, Adriano believed, should not be passive or negative. Rather, it should provide joy and have a noble purpose, leading people to a better life. In Adriano's mind, companies have a moral obligation toward their workers. After all, it is through workers' physical and intellectual contributions that companies grow. Adriano believed that companies should not only provide their employees with economic rewards, but also promote cultural and social initiatives that would help them and their families flourish alongside the firm. The management scholar James March first wrote about this trade-off between efficiency and innovation in 1991, highlighting the contrast between exploitation and exploration in organizations. Exploration, or looking for and identifying new ideas and ways of doing things, involves risk-taking, experimentation, flexibility, play, discovery, and innovation. Exploitation, in contrast, involves improving and refining existing products and processes through efficiency, selection, implementation, and execution. These two activities, March argued, require substantially different capabilities, processes, and cultures. Groups organized around exploration tend to have flexible structures and are associated with improvisation, autonomy, chaos, and emerging businesses and technologies. Meanwhile, those organized for exploitation are more often associated with routine processes, control and bureaucracy, and stable markets and technology. Exploitation, March noted, often crowds out exploration. Departing from the single-minded focus on efficient processes that characterized Ford's methods, Adriano Olivetti was able to get the balance between exploration and exploitation just right. He became the company's general manager in 1932 and its president in 1938. Under Adriano's leadership, the firm adopted a much more efficient production system, thus following in Ford's footsteps. But unlike Ford, the company also invested in its workforce in ways that were rather unusual, especially at that time. In the northwest Italian town of Ivrea, new factory buildings were built almost entirely of glass, so that the workers could see the mountains and valleys, and those outside could see what was happening inside. Cultured, sophisticated, and community-minded, Adriano was an engineer fascinated by art, design, and architecture, and he drew on these interests in his corporate role. Under Adriano, Olivetti's design strategy became integrated into the product development process. In fact, in 1937, the company was one of the first to integrate a graphic design department into its corporate structure. Rather than limiting designers to fashioning the appearance of products only after the engineers had developed them, Olivetti's designers were equal partners from the start. In the 1940s, Olivetti launched creative new products into the market, like its DiviSumma electric calculator, launched in 1948, a 10-key printing machine capable of division, which became very popular. In 1969, Olivetti's Valentine typewriter turned what was once a utilitarian machine into a must-have of the day. Using modern materials, a new manufacturing process, and a clever design, the portable Valentine typewriter created a new mass-market product category. The company also started to diversify, specifically into the production of the first mechanical calculators and a highly innovative electronics division. Thanks to the fact that designers were so involved in the process, Olivetti's products became known for being highly functional but also aesthetically unique. For instance, the Valentine typewriter had smooth lines and punchy colors. It came in red, white, green, and blue, making it fun and adding personality to an area that had long taken itself too seriously, the office. At the same time, Olivetti expanded internationally, opening subsidiaries across Latin America and Europe. The company grew from a factory with fewer than 900 employees in its early years to a multinational firm with about 80,000 workers at 10 establishments in Italy and 11 abroad. By the 1970s, Olivetti had become an undisputed leader in industrial design, a phrase Steve Jobs would use a decade later when talking about what he wanted his company, Apple, to be. Though initially impressed by the production efficiencies he saw at Ford, Adriano believed the intensive work schedules overly stressed employees and could, in the long term, alienate them. He not only paid Olivetti workers more than other companies did at the time, but he went to great lengths to ensure that they remained engaged, curious, and exposed to knowledge and culture from different disciplines. Under Adriano, new factories included playgrounds for workers' children, libraries filled with tens of thousands of books and magazines, and rooms for film screenings and debates. Tech companies like Google and Facebook offer similar perks these days, but they were rather uncommon at the time. He also hired writers, poets, and other intellectuals. During the 1950s, for example, the novelist and psychologist Ottiero Ottieri oversaw recruitment, and the poet Giovanni Giudici ran the firm's library, which Adriano referred to as the factory of the culture. Workers were given a 2-hour break for lunch, 1 hour to eat food, the other to eat culture, by reading books from the library, or attending concerts and talks by famous intellectuals Olivetti had invited. Mechanical engineers received lessons on the history of music or the French Revolution. For Christmas, management gave employees special editions of books that were considered classics, or custom-made calendars with reproductions of famous artworks or illustrations made by emerging artists. The company also sponsored the renovation of various masterpieces, including Leonardo da Vinci's The Last Supper. Adriano had no data to support his approach to management, and other executives often thought he was wasting time with all these activities and initiatives for his employees. But he was clearly spot on with his intuition. By investing in workers' well-being and curiosity, his company kept innovating and putting successful products on the market. In addition to the traditional typewriter, Olivetti developed products that allowed the company to expand into new markets, including, eventually, the first personal computer in the world, Programma 101, or P101, in 1964. By making innovation the core of his company's production strategy, Adriano Olivetti fostered a highly creative environment for his staff. He believed that the success of Olivetti products was about much more than the processes. It was about what he did for his people. He gave workers much more ownership over the manufacturing process, invested in their well-being, and encourage them to be curious. Olivetti is the oldest technology company in Italy, and it has also become the largest. In the mid-1990s, it was the second largest computer maker in Europe. Its great design and innovation are the key sources of that success, together with the company's vast range of products, from the first mass-produced personal computer and typewriters to fax machines, cash registers, and inkjet printers. In a similar manner today, design and consulting company IDEO seeks to hire what are known as T-shaped employees. This terminology apparently originated at the management consulting firm McKinsey & Company in internal hiring conversations. The vertical stroke of the T in T-shaped employee refers to the depth of knowledge and skill an employee relies on to add her contribution to the creative process. The horizontal stroke of the T refers to an employee's inclination for collaboration across functions, which consists of two aspects, empathy and curiosity. Empathy is what allows people to take another person's perspective when considering problems and to listen actively. Curiosity refers to an interest in other people's activities and disciplines, an interest so strong that an employee may start to practice them. Adriano hired prestigious designers to design Olivetti's typewriters, people who clearly had deep skills, but he also assured that the workplace was structured to nurture their empathy and curiosity. Like IDEO's leaders, he believed that people perform at their best not because they're specialists, but rather because their depth of skill is accompanied by an intellectual curiosity that leads them to keep exploring. Research evidence for a link between curiosity and innovation abounds. Spencer Harrison of the INSEAD Business School in France and his colleagues examined this relationship in the context of an e-commerce website where people sell handmade goods. Over a 2-week period, the artisans answered questions about the level of curiosity they experienced at work. Their productivity was then assessed by counting the number of new items each artisan listed over a 2-week period. Curiosity was associated with a greater creative productivity. A 1-unit increase in curiosity, that is, moving from a score of 5 to 6 on a 7-point scale, was associated with a 34% increase in productivity. Curiosity produces performance benefits in all kinds of jobs. Take the case of call centers, where jobs are heavily structured. As a result, turnover is generally high. To make matters worse, calls are often monitored, and employees' performance is evaluated based on the speed at which they handle each call. Harrison and his colleagues asked new employees from 10 different call center organizations to complete a survey that measured their curiosity before they started working in their company's call center. 4 weeks into the job, the same employees reported on different aspects of their job, such as how well they were learning and whether they were seeking information by reaching out to other colleagues. The most curious people the company had hired were those who sought the most information from coworkers, and they were the best able to use that information in a way that allowed them to be creative and perform at higher levels. Some of them, the researchers learned in follow-up interviews, saw their jobs less as an assembly line in your brain, in the words of one employee, and more like a puzzle in which they had to figure out new ways to use the prescribed system to benefit customers. It was these people who became the highest performers. My own research finds that curious people often end up being star performers in their organizations for several different reasons. They have larger networks, they're more comfortable asking questions, and they more easily create and nurture ties with others at work, ties that are critical to their career development and success. The organization also benefits, as these curious employees are more connected to others who can help them overcome work challenges and are more motivated to go the extra mile. When Adriano was the CEO of Olivetti, one of his workers was caught leaving the factory with a bag full of iron pieces and machinery. The colleagues who caught him accused him of being a thief and suggested the company fire him. The employee protested that he wasn't stealing, but rather taking the parts home to work on a project over the weekend because he didn't have enough time to do it at work. When Adriano heard the story, he asked to speak with the worker directly. At their meeting, the worker explained that he had a plan to build a new machine, a calculator. Intrigued, Adriano put him in charge of the production process for the new machine. Not long after, the new electrical calculating machine was built, the first of its type on the market. The Divisumma offered automatic calculation with all four basic mathematic operations. In the 1950s and 1960s, Divisumma became a popular product across the globe and was a dramatic, lucrative success for Olivetti. Adriano promoted the worker to the position of technical director. Rather than firing the employee, Adriano gave him the opportunity to play with his curiosity, with astounding results. Highway 101 runs for over 1,500 miles on the west coast of the United States, through the states of California, Oregon, and Washington. Back in 2004, an anonymous billboard made its appearance on the highway south of San Francisco, in the heart of the Silicon Valley. The billboard had a strange ad on it. Bracket, first 10-digit prime found in consecutive digits of E, bracket, .com. Across the country, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, a similar mysterious banner appeared at the Harvard Square subway stop. The message contains a challenging math puzzle. As I found out after a bit of searching online, since I couldn't remember this from my math classes, E, the base of the natural system of logarithms, has a numerical value of 2.71828. The number actually goes on forever, but eventually you will get to the first 10-digit prime found consecutively within it. The correct answer is 742746631.com. If you were curious enough to solve the problem and then go to the website, you would have found another equation to solve, an even harder problem. Eventually, if you were a determined enough problem solver, you would have found yourself at a Google web page asking you to upload your resume. From there, the few remaining contestants landed an interview at Google headquarters. Tech companies have relied on mathematical and logical puzzles for quite some time, at least since the 1950s, in their attempts to recruit the most curious candidates. For instance, Microsoft, which popularized this hiring method, posed the following problem to candidates in first-round interviews. Imagine an old-fashioned clock with two hands on it. When it is at 12 o'clock, the minute hand is directly on top of the hour hand. The question is, how many times a day does it happen that the minute hand is right over the hour hand, and how would you determine the exact times of the day that this occurs? Other companies use more obvious methods to find curious employees, from explicitly encouraging curious people to apply in job postings, to asking candidates about their interests and hobbies outside of work. With its billboard recruitment plan, Google was looking for people who are, according to an official blog post written by Googlers in 2004, geeky enough to be annoyed at the very existence of a math problem they haven't solved, and smart enough to rectify the situation. If engineers were curious enough to pursue answers to the problem, they had a quality the company was looking for. Curiosity encourages new ways of thinking, challenges long-held assumptions, and fuels transformative change. As Google CEO Eric Schmidt has commented, "We run this company on questions, not answers." Recruiting creative people is certainly important, and finding them can be challenging. But by far, the biggest challenge that organizations and their leaders face comes after an employee is hired. How do we keep people creative? The curiosity we all naturally had as children does not express itself as easily when we become adults. And as we enter new relationships, whether at work or in life, we all face the risk of seeing our creativity decline because we stop asking questions. In one survey, I asked about 250 people who had recently started new jobs with various companies about their level of curiosity when they started. Although they started off at different levels, after 6 months passed, their curiosity level had dropped by more than 20% on average. Why? We ask too few questions when approaching problems. We work to finish assigned tasks without questioning the process or asking about overall goals. And rather than celebrating curiosity, our leaders often discourage it. They see its value, but their actions often tell an alarmingly different story. In another survey, I asked over 3,000 employees from several industries to answer a few questions about curiosity. Most of them, 92%, credited curious people for bringing new ideas into teams and organizations, and viewed curiosity as a catalyst to job satisfaction, innovation, and high performance. Yet, only a minority, about 24%, reported feeling curious in their jobs on a regular basis. And about 70% reported facing barriers to asking more questions at work, like the pressure to execute their work at a rapid pace, the reluctance to take risks, fearing some sort of punishment in the case of failure, and the unwillingness to question existing procedures. We all differ in how curious we are by nature, but no matter our natural level of curiosity, in organizations, curiosity can be fostered. Leaders can encourage it throughout their company by first being more inquisitive and curious themselves. Curiosity needs champions, and that needs to start at the top. Whether in brainstorming sessions or in regular firm meetings, leaders can set a good example by asking why and what if, just as Zanardi did at Ritz-Carlton and Greg Dyke did at the BBC, and by encouraging others to do the same. As the sense of curiosity grows in a workplace, some good answers will likely follow. Outside of company meetings, leaders can stress the importance of curiosity in other ways. For instance, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg publicly sets new personal learning goals for himself each year, inspiring others inside the firm to do the same. In the last few years, Zuckerberg's goals included learning Mandarin, reading a book every other week, meeting a new person every day who doesn't work at Facebook, and visiting and meeting people in every state of the United States. Organizations can also foster curiosity by encouraging their employees to explore their interests. When Adriano Olivetti was presented with a thief, he recognized a talent who needed the time and resources to explore a great idea. Other successful leaders and organizations have done the same kind of thing. Since 1996, the manufacturing conglomerate United Technologies, or UTC, has provided up to $12,000 in tuition per year to employees seeking advanced degrees on a part-time basis, no strings attached. Employers are often not in favor of training staff, fearing they might find a job with a competitor and leave the firm with their expensively acquired skills. But Gail Jackson, UTC's Vice President of Human Resources, thinks differently about this. She notes, "We want people who are intellectually curious. It is better to train and have them leave than not to train and have them stay." Another way leaders can foster curiosity in employees is by acknowledging the limits of their own knowledge with a simple, "I don't know, let's find out," or by highlighting the inherent ambiguity of a decision the company is facing. At one company I visited, employees were asked to come up with "what if" and "how might we" questions about the firm's goals and its plans. As a sign that questioning was not only encouraged, but also supported and rewarded, employees and management chose the best of these questions to display on banners on the company's walls. Maintaining this sense of curiosity is crucial to creativity and innovation in an organization. Think of the story behind Polaroid. The inspiration that led to the instant camera was born out of a question that the 3-year-old daughter of its inventor, Edwin H. Land, asked in the mid-1940s. When her father snapped a photo, she found herself waiting impatiently to see it. She learned that the film had to be processed first, but as her father explained this to her, she wondered aloud, "Why do we have to wait for the picture?" There's a good management lesson to learn in the way parents respond when their baby comes across something new. First, a baby will express surprise and then look at the parent. If the parent makes a sad face or a face that evokes negative emotions, then the child's surprised expression turns negative. If the parent expresses pleasant excitement, on the other hand, then the child does as well. Similarly, at work, we'll continue questioning and exploring only if we are part of a group or organization characterized by what researchers refer to as psychological safety, a shared belief that members can take risks. If a workplace does not feel safe, a person is reluctant to ask questions, or even to bring up problems that would clearly make the group better off. When Harvard Business School management scholar Amy Edmondson studied medical teams in various hospitals, she discovered that the best teams were the ones that were psychologically safe. Team members were not afraid to admit to errors and discussed them openly with their colleagues. In a group that is psychologically safe, you would not fear being embarrassed about raising unorthodox questions, ideas, or doubts. Think of one of the most beloved characters in children's literature, Curious George. The little high-energy monkey who lives with the man with the yellow hat dives into every experience he comes across, eager to explore and experiment. The man with the yellow hat is always ready to bail George out of the sticky situations he gets himself into. For instance, flying by in a helicopter just when George floats too high on a bunch of balloons. Fortunately for George, he benefits from his curiosity, enjoying new experiences and discoveries, because he's never punished for getting into trouble. Too often, there is no room for Curious George characters in the workplace. People who explore and end up with unsuccessful experiments, or even worse, create a messy situation, are usually punished for it. Rarely are they praised for championing the value of experimentation regardless of outcome. There are many ways that leaders can let employees know they value curiosity. When Satya Nadella joined Microsoft in 2014 as the new CEO, for instance, he changed the criteria in the firm's performance review so that they would include an evaluation of how well employees learn from their colleagues, share ideas, and apply their new knowledge. Ed Catmull, who co-founded Pixar Animation Studios and is now its president, worried that Pixar's success would lead new hires to be in awe, to the point that they would not challenge existing practices. To address his worry, during onboarding sessions, when new employees are welcomed to the firm to get socialized into it, he shares examples of how the company has made certain bad choices in the past. He stresses the simple but often overlooked fact that we all make mistakes and that Pixar is not perfect. His unusual candor gives new recruits the license they need to be curious. Training can also foster healthy questioning. Recently, an organization approached INSEAD's Spencer Harrison for advice on encouraging curiosity in its employees. With his colleagues, he created two versions of an online training program for the firm. Half of the company's employees were taught what the researchers called the GROW method, which explained that success would come from following existing processes. The other half received a modified version called the Go Back method, which asked employees to go back and question the common assumptions we all tend to hold about goals, roles, and the organization as a whole. As an example, employees learning the Go Back method were told the story of a scientist who was trying to help people with diseases that caused their extremities to shake, which made it difficult for them to complete certain activities, such as eating cereal for breakfast. Initially, the scientist was focused on the idea of creating a drug that would stop the shaking. But as he thought more about the goal of stopping the tremors, he came up with a mechanical solution, attaching a gyroscope to a spoon so that the spoon would absorb the tremors. Weeks later, managers at the company rated the employees who went through the Go Back training as more creative and innovative than those who received the more traditional training, without knowing who had engaged in which program. Harrison and his colleagues also examined the type of connections people created at work by looking at the emails they exchanged with one another. They found that people who went through the Go Back training changed how they engaged with their colleagues. They expanded their networks, sent more emails, and as a result gathered more information, which allowed them to be more creative in their jobs. When we ask questions about the aspects of our job and organization that we generally take for granted, we build relationships with colleagues more easily, and our ideas get more interesting. Are you still wondering about how Houdini made the elephant disappear? Researchers often use the vanishing elephant trick to trigger curiosity and study its effects on people's behavior. For instance, doctoral student Lydia Hochtvedt of Boston College and her colleagues divided participants into two groups and asked them to read different versions of a news article on the vanishing elephant trick. For one group, the article described the vanishing elephant trick as an industry standard and included an explanation of exactly how Houdini accomplished it. Participants were asked to describe how they would feel if they were watching in the audience and how they thought Houdini did the trick, which had already been explained to them. They submitted their responses via computer. After a short delay, they were informed that their answer regarding the solution to the trick was correct. For the second group, the experiment's curiosity condition, the article did not include any clues about how the trick worked. After reading the article, the participants had to describe how they would feel if they were in the audience watching and how they thought Houdini did the trick. And as with the other group, they submitted their responses via computer. But in this case, it appeared as if their answer to the question about how the trick worked was being compared to a correct answer in a database. In reality, this was simply a time delay in the program. After a few seconds, participants were told that their answer was close, but not fully correct. In this way, participants in the second group remained curious about how the trick was accomplished, while those in the control group were led to feel confident that they knew the nature of the trick. Next, all participants moved on to a different task, generating additional ideas for magic tricks. They had to imagine that they were Houdini and were hoping to perform a trick better than the elephant one. Professional magicians with over 20 years of experience evaluated the creativity of the participants' responses. In addition, independent coders read participants' answers and rated the degree to which their magic trick ideas moved beyond the core aspects of the original vanishing elephant trick. So, for instance, a response such as, "I would put the curtain over the box with the elephant in it and then make the box disappear, leaving just the elephant," received a low score because the idea involved the three core aspects of the vanishing elephant trick, disappearing, elephants, and boxes. But a response like, "I would perform a trick where it looked like I was levitating," received the highest possible score because it did not contain any of the core aspects of the original trick. Participants in the curiosity condition generated ideas that the professional magicians evaluated as creative significantly more often, 69% of the time, than those in the control condition, 34% of the time. Their ideas were also less fixated on core aspects of the vanishing elephant trick. Curiosity led participants to generate ideas that experts judged as more creative and that diverged more dramatically from the status quo. Throughout his career, once Houdini had mastered one escape, like freeing himself from locked handcuffs, he would quickly move on to mastering a new challenge, like having the local police in a town he visited restrain him and managing to escape. Once he'd mastered each of these situations, he decided to try jumping into rivers while handcuffed and chained. Houdini was constantly looking for new ways to challenge himself. He pushed himself relentlessly and trained hard for his various difficult feats. When we realize that we don't have an immediate answer to a puzzle or problem that confronts us, our mind fills with creative ideas, if we let it. Every single day, we can choose between focusing on what we know or what we don't know. When we do the latter, we engage our curiosity and are more likely to see the world as Houdini did. Houdini inspired awe in his audiences through his magic. Greg Dyke took the helm at the BBC by asking questions rather than providing answers. Google found rare talent by making potential job candidates wonder. And Adriano Olivetti created an almost magical workplace where he used various tricks to broaden his employees' interests. Although tough and competitive at different times and in different contexts, all these players were able to instill curiosity in those they interacted with and remain curious themselves. Their inquisitive nature and sense of wonder was contagious. As it turns out, the vanishing trick was not actually invented by Houdini. The credit for it goes to Charles Morrett, a hypnotist and illusionist from Yorkshire, England, whose trick, the disappearing donkey, was a precursor to Houdini's vanishing elephant. For the donkey trick, Morrett would usher the uncooperative animal into a wooden chamber on wheels, and the audience could see that there were no trapdoors being used. As Morrett closed up the sides, the audience could hear the sound of the donkey's hooves pounding the wood of the chamber that held him prisoner. Unbeknownst to those in the audience, the chamber had been specially designed, and when Morid opened it up again, the donkey had disappeared. Audiences loved the act, which eventually brought Morit to Houdini's attention. Despite his inventive genius, Morit's ability and charisma as a performer were lacking. Morit also needed money, so he sold Houdini the secrets to many of his best and most carefully guarded illusions, including the disappearing donkey. The switch from donkey to elephant was Morit's idea as well, a suggestion he made to Houdini to make the stunt even more memorable. Here is how the vanishing elephant trick actually worked. When Jenny entered the box, her trainer hid the elephant behind a large mirror that extended on a diagonal from the corner of the box that was closest to the audience to the center of the doors at the back of the box. When the doors were reopened, the audience saw a seemingly empty box, not realizing that they were actually viewing only one half of the box's interior and its reflection. Though Houdini did not invent the trick, he brought his amazing showmanship to it, and he constantly pushed to make it better. The fact that audiences remained amazed by the trick for decades, and that no one could figure it out until one of Houdini's prop engineers divulged the secret to Modern Mechanics magazine in 1929, was due in large part to how well Houdini performed and perfected it. For the stunned audience, Houdini's vanishing elephant magic trick raised a question with no clear answer, and it inspired the curiosity of generations. Chapter 4. The Hudson River is a Runway, a Talent for Perspective. There's a literal freedom you feel when you're at the controls, gliding above the surface of the earth, no longer bound by gravity. Even at a few thousand feet, you get a wider perspective. Captain Chesley Sullenberger. On a January afternoon in 2009, U.S. Airways Flight 1549 took off from LaGuardia Airport in New York, headed for Charlotte, North Carolina. The weather in New York was cold, about 21 degrees Fahrenheit. The winds coming out of the north were not too strong, and the sky was mostly clear with only scattered clouds. It had stopped snowing earlier that morning. The plane carried 150 passengers and 5 crew members. Only one seat was empty. For the crew, this was the final leg of a 4-day trip. Captain Chesley Sullenberger, an experienced pilot known as Sully, shared the cockpit with Jeff Skiles, a first officer with whom he'd never worked before. Less than 2 minutes into the flight, Sully looked out of the cockpit's front windows to see birds, massive ones, their long wings extended horizontally, flying headlong toward the plane. The plane was climbing above 3,000 feet, the engines whining with the effort, at just over 230 miles an hour. "Birds!" Sully shouted. At the same moment, the sound of something similar to a very bad storm filled the cockpit and cabin, as if the plane were being pelted by hail or heavy rain. The birds began to hit the plane just below the windshield, smashing against the nose, the wings, and the engines with a series of thuds. Then a loud screeching noise came from the engines, followed by severe vibrations, as if the engines were protesting the sudden disruption. A pungent, charred smell entered the cabin, and then the engine noises subsided, an eerie quiet. Sully said everyone heard a rhythmic rumbling and rattling, like a stick being held against moving bicycle spokes. It was a strange windmilling sound from broken engines. The Airbus A320-214 has two engines, and both had failed. With so little altitude and both engines destroyed, there was little time to act. If the plane had lost one engine rather than two, the pilot and first officer would have been able to maintain control of the aircraft. They would have declared an emergency, and with the air traffic controller's help, found a nearby airport where they could likely land safely. But without any working engines, the plane had become a very heavy glider, loaded with fuel. "My aircraft," Sully said, and took control of the plane. "Your aircraft," Skiles responded. He pulled out the aircraft's quick reference handbook, found the checklist for loss of thrust in both engines, and got to work. "Mayday, mayday, mayday," Sully called out to air traffic control. Patrick Harton, the air traffic controller sitting at his radar position at the New York Terminal Radar Approach Control, located on Long Island, didn't hear the Mayday call. At the same moment Sully was calling out for help, Harton was making a transmission of his own, to Sully himself, giving him routine direction for the flight. When Harton released his transmission,